I'm Shane Bishop, senior pastor of Christ Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. We are in week 4 of the Game Changer series. I'm ready to go. Let's get at it. We are in week 4 of our Be a Game Changer series. Let's jump right into our organizing thoughts. There are 7 of them. Number 1, game changers understand that the game needs changed. Number 2, change begins with us. Number 3, things don't change on their own. Throughout the Bible, when God needs things to change, God raises up a leader. Number 4, new outcomes require new inputs. Do you want your life or the life of someone you know to have better outcomes? Then put in different inputs. Number 5, we must be willing to be changed. How many of our prayers are really petitions to God to change other people? We must be willing to be changed. Number 6, we must allow God to change us. We got to say, God, if you don't affect change in me, I don't have a chance of doing this on my own. And number 7, change does not come easy. In week 1, we looked at an elite soldier by the name of Ehud who picked a fight only God could finish. And he won 80 years of peace for his people. Ehud was the arrow and not the target. In week 2, a disenfranchised slave by the name of Jochebed said no to the mandated death of her son. She said no, and she threw the switch and got salvation history back on the right track. And then last week, we looked at the life of a cubicle dwelling mid-level government bureaucrat by the name of Mordecai, who found that he had been born for such a time as this, and through his influence averted the complete genocide of his people. You know, we've looked at game changers from the top. We've looked at game changers from the bottom. We've looked at game changers from the middle. But today we're going to take a look at how the game can be changed by somebody completely outside. In fact, not only outside an organization or outside a family, but in this particular case, from outside the boundaries of propriety. A pagan woman who ran a house of ill repute in a doomed Canaanite city named Rahab is the star of our message today. Rahab is an Amorite name based on Ra, who is the Egyptian sun god, who's the chief of the Egyptian deities. The Hebrew denotes her occupation. She's a prostitute. So I want to consider her story, and I want to put something in your head, and I'm going to keep it in your head here. God makes scandalous choices. God makes scandalous choices. A huge people group had left Egypt under Moses after 400 years of slavery. And now they were planning to occupy the land that was once promised to their ancestor Abraham. And you remember Moses, right? Moses is the leader of this people group. Moses is Jochebed's boy. Moses is the little baby that she put in the boat and put in the bulrushes of the Nile River. This is the Moses. So I need you to understand, these stories are tied together. They don't just stand along. They run along a continuum. Now, all of the sudden, the people group are headed to Canaan. It is a conglomeration of city-states, each having their own king, their own army, their own culture, and their own cacophony of gods. The Canaanites occupied parts of what is now Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, Palestine. It's a pretty big swatch, all in what we would call the Middle East. Marching upon them was this horde of clannish relatives who came out of Egypt, who are generally called Hebrews, then Israelites, and then Jews. A trip that should have taken a few weeks had taken 4 decades. And now, as they seem right on the precipice of entering the promised land, Moses dies. And maybe that was just as well. You see, the people needed a political leader to get them out of slavery, but they need a general to get them into the promised land. Enter Joshua. Joshua immediately announced that the people would attack Canaan in 3 days. And to get a lay of the land, he sent 2 spies on a quick hitter mission to infiltrate and evaluate the city state of Jericho and the land that surrounded it. You see, whoever controlled Jericho controlled the trade routes. And whoever controlled the trade routes controlled the region. If you want the promised land, you got to have Jericho. If Joshua was going to take an inroad into the land of promise, it had to go through the city. Now, Jericho sits about 900 feet below sea level. It's actually today, it's the lowest elevation of any city in the world. It's hotter than 6 kinds of smoke about 13 months of year. But Jericho had something and has always had something that all of its neighbors lacked: water. Jericho is in the middle of the desert, but Jericho sits on top of a spring. It is called the City of Palms, and it's built on this spring that so changes the game for the city. Jericho gets between 4 and 6 inches of rain a year, but because of the spring, they actually could irrigate right in the desert. When you travel to Jericho, those of you that have gone with me to Israel, those that are going in January, when you go to Jericho, it's just this little plot of green right in the middle of the desert. Archaeologists think that Jericho at this time probably had about 2,000 residents, many more in the surrounding area. Now, this clandestine pair, these 2 spies, would have played themselves off as traitors or refugees or just travelers, and they would have done their very best to stay under the radar as they enter the city. But news is out. Everybody's got to know. There's this huge throng of Hebrews that are headed north from Egypt, and Jericho would have absolutely been on red alert. The pair checks into the house of Rahab. This house is built into the city wall, so it would share a wall with the wall of the city. And it was a kind of place that provided strangers food, lodging, and comfort in the illicit sense of the word. It is exactly the kind of place that wayfaring men in the roaring BCs would stay when they went through a city. Now, the Hebrew text declares Rahab to be a prostitute. And frankly, there's no reason to doubt it. The other thing it's really interesting is it doesn't make any value judgments on that. You see, then as now, there were many reasons that a woman could be thrust into the sex industry. But many were slaves or young widows with no family. They might have been poor young women who simply had no other way to make a living. That being said, Rahab doesn't seem to be working at the place. She seems to be running the place. The brothel, if you will, is at her address. The Bible doesn't seem to think it's odd that the 2 spies stayed there. It makes no value judgments at all. It simply presents it all as fact. So despite the precautions, the 2 men had not entered the city undetected. And so the city officials, on behalf of the local king, ask Rahab to produce the 2 spies. I'm guessing this happened all the time. They're going to interrogate them. It's kind of like, think about when you enter a country, you go through customs, they may want to chat with you a second. They're going to interrogate these 2 men and see what is going on here. But Rahab, who I'm guessing this happened to all the time, Rahab in this one instance doesn't comply. She doesn't comply. In fact, she sends the king's representatives on a wild goose chase. This took an incredible amount of courage. It's exceptional. It's completely unexpected. There's nothing in it for Rahab to do this. So we got to ask, why did she do it? Not only does she misdirect the king's officials, she hides the 2 spies under bundles of flax that are drying in the sun for the harvest. Now, flax is a plant. It's used to make ropes, but especially used to make linen. Other than wool, which comes from sheep, linen was something you could make clothing out of. And so flax is something you have to soak it in water. The water turns brackish. The water smells terrible. And then you pull it up out of the water and you let it dry. Now, because it's a cash crop, you can't just do that outside. So you got to keep an eye on it so people don't steal it. And so she would have had this happening on her roof. Hiding the two men under the drying flax was really a pretty good idea. Because for lack of a better word, it was really stinky up there. And nobody was in a big hurry to look. So she conceals the two men. There is no evidence that Rahab is a believer in God or Yahweh in the Hebrew. There's no reason to believe that Rahab is particularly devout. In fact, all evidence is quite the contrary. But there is something about this woman that compelled her to cast her lot with the God of the Hebrews. And in this simple act of hiding the spies, Rahab does something that history will never forget. She chose the right side. I mean, if she doesn't hide those spies, not only does she die and her family die completely unremembered, but if she doesn't hide those spies, we never hear a thing about Rahab. What an incredibly courageous thing to do. And how important is it to choose the right side? There are four things that the text directly tells us about God. If you're taking notes, now's a good time to do it. Number one, verse 9a, I know that the Lord has given this land to you. So number one, God is great. Rahab knew. But how did she know? You see, I believe that humans are hardwired with a capacity for faith. And it is to that capacity that nature witnesses and God speaks. Rahab was convinced that this great God had already given Israel the victory. She just needed to align herself with the winning side. My friends, do you hear what I'm saying here? You have the victory. Whatever it is in your life that you need God to do, you already have the victory through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. You just need to align yourself with the right side. Number two, God is awesome. Verse 9b, great fear of you has fallen upon us so that all who live in this country are in fear because of what God has done for you. One interesting thing about God is that God cares about his reputation. God cares about his reputation. I believe that part of our calling as a church is to make the name of the Lord famous. I really do. And there's strong scriptural evidence that supports that idea. God is concerned about his reputation. God desires that we make his name famous. What does Rahab say? We've heard about your God. We know what your God has done for you. Well, how would she know it? People have witnessed to it. My friend, has God done incredible things in your life? Witness to it. Post it on Facebook. Let people know what God has done for you and make the name of the Lord famous. As we celebrate what God has done for us, we glorify his name and our enemies tremble in fear at the greatness of our God. Number three, God is merciful. Verse 12, now then, please swear to me by the Lord that you will show kindness to my family. She had no reason to trust these spies, these soldiers. I mean, I don't know much about them, but you just got to guess. These spies and these soldiers were not necessarily the most trustworthy people in the world. After all, they are there to destroy the city. But she's ready to make a deal because she understands something. She's a businesswoman. And today, she holds all of the cards. And she knows that tomorrow she will hold none of the cards. You see, the spies are in hiding. One word from Rahab, and they're arrested. And they'll be hanging by the end of the day if they're lucky, but more likely their heads will be on a pole on the city wall. On the other hand, Rahab appeals to the mercy of the Lord through the rough exterior of the two spies. What she's really saying is, guys, I don't have any doubt. You guys are savages. But your God is merciful. And I appeal to the mercy of your God. Can we make a deal based on the mercy of your God? Number four comes from verse 13. Give me a sure sign that you will spare the lives of my family and that you will save us from death. Number four, God is faithful. God is faithful. Joshua's plan is to wipe Jericho from the face of the earth. That's the plan. Rahab knows how these things work. The walls are going to be assaulted. If the walls are breached, the residents are going to be killed at worst, enslaved at best. The visitors will steal everything, or the victors will steal everything in the city that's of any value. They will rebuild what they tore down, and the victors are going to inhabit the city. I mean, this is a people group looking for a place to dwell. Remember that. They are coming in to take over, not just defeat. In return for sparing the lives of the spies, Rahab asks in good faith that the spies spare the life of her family. Note, Rahab has a dependent family, but there's no husband listed, making me think she may well have been a young widow. But she is the person responsible for her dependence in this sense. Now, Rahab expects the spies to keep the word, keep their word, not because they're such great guys, but because they serve such a great God. So the two spies would have discovered that Jericho was well fortified, that it had plenty of food, that it had maintained a pretty good army, and most of all, they would have found out that they had a limitless supply of water. You can live a long time if you have water. And there was nothing they could do to cut off the water source. Bottom line, if God wanted to give the Hebrews Jericho, God would have to intervene on their behalf. You get a walled city that you can't siege, you can lose 10,000 soldiers in a day and not even injure one of the enemy. God is going to have to intercede. As the spies escape the city, they promise to spare Rahab and her household from the oncoming invasion, and she is to mark her house with a scarlet rope. Back to the flax, a scarlet rope, a rope that would have been dyed. Something you really can't miss. Some people have asked if this is where you get the idea of like a red light district from the scarlet robe. Not a chance. Not a chance. Don't think that's it at all. Joshua chapter 6 recounts a one-week battle that went something like this. Joshua's army marched around the city one day, and then they marched around it the next day. They marched around the city one time for 6 consecutive days. You got to remember, the people are already horrified. They are in absolute fear, and every day they see the army just march around, the people are scared to death. Then on the 7th day, they march around 7 times, and they blow their trumpets in a loud blast. All the soldiers yell and scream, and the Bible says the walls just fell down. The victory belonged to the Lord. Salvation history has just taken a huge leap forward. The family of Rahab is not only spared, but the family of Rahab is adopted into biblical history. So let's take a look at what we can learn from the stories. Let's take a look at how we can be game changers. Number one, God makes scandalous choices. Rahab is a prostitute, for heaven's sakes. God makes scandalous choices. A lot of people think God can never use them because of their past. Enter Rahab. Number two, Rahab is just living her life. She's not particularly devout. She doesn't seem to be a worshiper of Yahweh. She's paying attention to things, though, but sometimes life just finds you. Sometimes the most significant things in our lives just happen. They just pop up, and we have to be ready for those. Number three, Rahab recognized the power of God. She knew that the God of the Hebrews was powerful, and she wanted to serve that powerful God. Number four, God brought the spies to Rahab. For whatever reason, God had been preparing Rahab's heart. Because she was already fearful of the Hebrews. She already had great respect for Yahweh. God had been preparing her heart, and then God brought the two spies right to her. I call those divine appointments. God's been working on both sides, brings them together for his glory. Number five, Rahab is all in. I mean, the second she deceives the king's officials, she's either chosen right or she's going to die, but she's all in. And then number six, Rahab is on the right side. I have heard people say, well, God is on my side. Here's the deal. God isn't on your side. You're not important enough to have a side. I'm not important enough to have a side. The question is, are we on God's side? Not whether God is on our side. Rahab is on God's side. And God's side wins. Believe me, I've read the back of the book, God's Side Wins. Because of the courage of Rahab, the book of Joshua ends with the death of Joshua, where he declares in chapter 24, verse 31, Israel served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and the leaders who outlived him. Just like in the Ehud story, Joshua brings peace to the people. And finally, the land promised to Abraham is inhabited by the descendants of Abraham. Now, if you've ever read Judges, we all know it's going to slip away. And the people are going to be disobedient before the Lord again, and a cycle is going to start all over. But let's not go there too quickly. Sometimes I think you just need to stop and take a deep breath, enjoy a victory, and just listen and see if God has anything to say. And I believe that he does. It's fascinating to me that Rahab's contributions to salvation history are not limited to the Old Testament. She gets three appearances in the New Testament as well. And she's not remembered for being an evil paragon of promiscuity or paganism. She's not remembered for any of those things. She's not remembered like Queen Jezebel is remembered as an antagonist in the biblical narrative. Rahab's not remembered like that at all. Rahab is remembered fondly in the biblical narrative. Take a look. Hebrews 11:1 defines faith as the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And then the author is giving evidence from the Old Testament of people who showed faith. Listen to this. It was by faith Rahab the prostitute did not die with all the others in her city who refused to obey God, for she had given a friendly welcome to the spies. Rahab is remembered for her faith. Then James 2 offers thoughts between the relationship of faith and works, concluding that faith without works is dead. And guess who is used as an example? Rahab. Rahab the prostitute was an example of this. She was made right with God by her actions when she hid those messengers and sent them safely away by a different road. Oh, but there's one more. And for the romantics among you, you're going to love this. In Matthew's opening genealogy, it appears that Rahab actually married Salmon, who was one of the two spies. And Rahab becomes included not only in the Jewish community, but in the tribe of Judah. Now, it says that Rahab and Salmon had a son named Boaz. And Boaz had a son named Obed, and Obed had a son named Jesse, and are you ready for this drum roll? And Jesse had a son named David, like King David, like the King David. Rahab, the prostitute, is an ancestor of the most famous king in the history of Israel. And you say, how could it get better than that? Oh, it gets better than that. You track David's genealogy down a bit. You finally come down to a guy by the name of Eluid. Let me tell you what happened. Eluid has a son named Eleazar. Eleazar has a son named Matan. Matan has a son named Jacob. Jacob has a son named Joseph. And Matthew writes, who was the husband of Mary, the mother of Jesus, who is called the Messiah. Yes, in Jesus' adopted human family from the Joseph line, there is a prostitute named Rahab, way way down the role in the family roll call. Yeah, there's a prostitute in the lineage of Jesus. How utterly scandalous. Scandalous. Rahab, my friends, is not remembered for what she got wrong. Rahab is remembered for what she got right. Are you ready to claim that for your legacy? When you think about you moving forward and the generations to come, are you ready to be remembered? Not for what you got wrong. Are you ready to be remembered for what you got right? Then let God lead you from sin and toward the life he created you to live. God led Rahab from running a house of prostitution toward becoming an ancestor of David and an ancestor of Jesus. Boy, is that a good from and a good toward. Are you ready to claim that for your legacy? Then get on God's side. See, I'm not sure if God's on my side. We don't get sides. You get on God's side. You get on God's side. Let God lead you from your old life toward your new life. You, my friend, may just be God's next scandalous choice. He makes those, you know. As we turn our heart toward communion, we are reminded of the work that Jesus has done. And you say, how can God take a prostitute? How could God take someone with such a sordid background? And how could God do such transforming things in the life that they are remembered so incredibly fondly? My friends, that's what God does. That's what God does. That's God's job description. He transforms people like you and me. So it doesn't really matter where you've been. It doesn't matter what you've done. It doesn't matter what your past is at all. Through the life and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, we can walk into a new life. We can be rebooted. God can make a scandalous choice and use the likes of you and me. Almighty God, thank you for this gift of wine and bread and those who receive it. Make it for us the body and blood of Christ, that we might be Christ's body in this world, redeemed by his blood. I'd like to ask our stewards if you would come forward at this time. And I would like to ask you to just engage in a moment of reflection and just join me in this prayer. God, would you move me from all of those things in my life that don't line up with you toward the life that you created for me? And then come up and celebrate this meal. Only Jesus could give this to us. Only Jesus could make this invitation. I hope you will join me in saying yes.